I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says minds are less a matter of fact and more a matter of perception. The mind is in the eye of the beholder. And depending on who we perceive to have minds, from dogs to God, babies to robots, matters a great deal. It gives them moral standing, respect, and responsibility. He's the author, our guest, Kurt Gray, of The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. And because it's about the mind, it looks into all kinds of human behavior and how minds can exist that would kill millions of people, how minds exist that can eat certain animals and not eat others, even though the animals we eat may be smarter than the animals that we don't eat. It looks at the minds of children, the minds of people who are in vegetative states. It's a really interesting book. And our guest has received his PhD in social psychology from Harvard. He is now assistant professor at the Mind Perception and Morality Lab at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And he studies how people see the minds of others and how mind perception underlies our most crucial and moral judgments. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour as we go in lots of directions. Kurt Gray, the guest, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Kurt. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
This can take you in so many directions, can it? Because after all, it's our mind.
You bet, yeah. And I think that was one of the reasons it was so fun to write the book, just because there's so many questions and so many interesting crypto minds, as we call them.
Yeah, exactly. Just tell me about this mind perception and morality lab that you lead at UNC. What do you do there?
Well, we do lots of different things. We do a lot of thinking, and we do a lot of psychological experiments. So we look at, you know, whether people think that others deserve torture. In one study that was funded by a grant from the John Templeton Foundation, we looked to see whether we could convince people that there was a ghost in the room with them. That was pretty fun.
Ooh.
Yeah, and the answer is yes. You know, we can convince at least some people that there's a ghost in the lab room with them.
That would be interesting to be in the lab room at that moment. All right, so depending on, a lot of this depends on who we perceive or what we perceive has a mind. How do we perceive that?
So when we perceive minds, we have to use a bunch of, you know, superficial characteristics, right? So the idea we talk about in the book is that there's a problem of other minds, a deep philosophical idea, and that is that you can never directly experience the mind of another.
Right.
You know, whether it's your spouse or your dog or what have you. And you just left with your best kind of perception. And so we use things like facial expressions and language. And that means it gets difficult when we interact with things that don't have language, like animals, or, you know, can't communicate, like vegetative patients and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing. I hadn't really thought a whole lot before about what might be going. It might be somebody you see every day and spend a lot of time with, but when they're sitting at their desk or sitting on the sofa or you're taking a walk with them, you really don't have any idea where their mind is going.
No, and it can be pretty unnerving if you really, like Matrix styles, right? You like look at someone and you think, I can never even really know if they think the same thoughts as I do or if there's even a mind, right? They could be this incredibly sophisticated robot, right? I just hit the side of their head and I would see circuit breakers. It's hard to know.
Yeah, it is hard to know. But if we have a club, if we have a mind club, then it's very important in terms of how we treat other human beings, who's admitted into the club. So does that vary greatly from person to person?
I think many of us agree. So when we ran this big mind survey, we found that many people agree on who gets in the club in an abstract sense. So we all agree that other people have minds and that, you know, most animals have minds, and then things like rocks and trees lack minds. But the difficulty hinges on nuance, right, and the devil's in the details. So you and I can both look at the exact same thing, like a cow, and see different amounts of mind. If I'm vegetarian, I see cows as having lots of mind, and if you are a meat eater, then you think cows have almost no mind, and both of those perceptions of mind supports our moral judgments of whether it's okay to eat meat.
Mm. You even include, and there are a lot of people like this, but you even include plants and vegetables and trees in your book that some feel that they experience pain.
Absolutely. Right. Some people, you know, years ago thought that plants could even telepathically, understand the pain of other plants. I think this has been debunked since then, but certainly plants, you know, that seem dumb when we look at them in everyday life seem much more intelligent if we look at them sped up, for instance, you know, flowers orienting to the sun or vines crawling quickly up trees. And so, you know, part of mind perception is just perceiving the right context to see action as intelligent.
Mm. And what was the mind survey you did?
So we asked a few thousand people to rate the mental capacities of different characters. So the mental capacities were things like feeling pain and pleasure and fear, you know, exerting self-control, remembering things. And the targets or characters included things like adult humans, children, babies, animals, a god, Google, dead people, vegetative patients, fetuses. And so people rated the minds of these targets. And then what we found is that minds are really perceived not along one dimension, which is what people have thought for a long time, but along two. We perceive the ability to think as independent and many times from the ability to feel.
Hmm.
And so we categorize mind as thinkers or feelers or sometimes both.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to animals, there's so much research being done now, and I know that you look at this as well, that shows that, I don't know if you call them minds or intelligence, of a lot of the creatures that we live with who we used to think were just absolutely stupid, they're not stupid.
Yeah, so I know back in the time of Descartes, he thought that animals were just little, like, fleshy automatons, right? Their nerves were like little wires. They were little machines. And science has certainly revealed that animals are much smarter than we ever thought, and that they have much deeper emotions. So one example we cover is of the bear garden in the 1800s in London. And basically what people would do is they'd go down to a stadium one afternoon, and they'd put a monkey on a horse. And then they would send a pack of dogs after the horse to basically tear down the monkey. And then eventually they'd send out a bear to destroy all the other animals.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was all misery. And today we think this is terrible. Right? But back then people not only were fine that this happened, but they thought it was amusing. So certainly our opinions of animal minds have changed drastically in 100 years.
So what happened to our minds to allow them to change so drastically?
Well, I think what we did was we just opened our kind of perception of the minds of animals. So we acknowledged that the kind of sounds that animals made and the faces that they made were indicative of, you know, real emotions and not just pretend emotions, that they had feelings like us. And so I think we recognize the humanity in some sense in animals.
Hmm. So why is it that this is really an interesting area. You asked the question, and how do you answer it in the book? Why is it that we eat pigs, but we don't eat seals? Pigs are smarter than seals. Why is it that the people in some Asian countries eat dogs, and we spend billions of dollars on our dogs and have them sit at the table with us?
Yeah, so, right, that's the big question of how is it that our perceptions of mind can often vary drastically from actual mental abilities. As you said, pigs are very, very smart, and they can do all sorts of things. And certainly baby seals, you know, who are still developing, aren't quite as smart as like a full-grown pig, but we think nothing of eating bacon, you know, while donating money to help harp seals in the Arctic. And I think, you know, part of it is cultural, and part of it's evolution, right? So our heart goes out to things that are furry and fluffy and have big eyes. In some sense, mind perception is triggered by cuteness, and cuteness is actually not really a very good marker of actually what has a mind. So crows are very smart. They can solve all sorts of physics problems, sometimes even better than children. But we think almost nothing of like shooting a crow, but we get very upset if you shot a kitten, even though kittens don't understand physics and can't figure out doorknobs and whatnot.
Hmm. At what point do we expect human beings' minds to be so evolved that they take responsibility for what they do?
Well, certainly adult humans we think to be evolved enough. But I think the gray areas are really interesting. So take teenagers, right?
Oh, you know, take teenagers, right.
Take teenagers, right.
All right, yeah.
Right, every parent will, like, nod their head safely now. But, right, we don't think babies have minds to be sophisticated, but we do think adults do. And so the in-between stage is really ambiguous, right, and really important. And part of it, in fact, depends upon how people act. So we don't expect teenagers to be morally accountable when they do something minor, let's say, like, you know, forget to lock the doors or drive the car and, like, sideswipe another car because they're not paying attention. But when teenagers do something really bad, right, so when teenagers commit murder, for instance, then we are compelled to find a mind there to blame for their evil, right? This is why we try teenagers to do really bad things in adult courts, because mind perception is based in part on the moral deeds that people do.
And before we go to phone calls, let's do different minds. Let's do the mind capable of killing 6 million Jews and contrast that with the mind that was capable. I saw you give a TED Talk recently, a 17-year-old who found his father with a car that had slipped off some kind of thing, safety thing, and fallen on him, and the kid picked up the car, a 2-ton car or something, off of his father so he could live. What happens in those minds? How can a mind be such that all these human beings are thought of what? As not having minds? As not having feelings? As not being human?
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, when we think of animals, we often engage this process called anthropomorphism, right? Is where we perceive human minds and things that aren't human. But the flip side is called dehumanization. And that's where we take things, or people really, that objectively have minds, and we take them away. And in fact, it's very easy, you know, scarily easy to take minds away from other people, as we do in all sorts of conflicts like the Holocaust, or, you know, when we get upset with Muslims for terrorism, Muslim extremists, and then we strip away mind from American Muslims. And research shows that we take away mind in one of two ways. One of them is you turn people into animals. You strip away their thinking and just turn them into feeling animals. And the other way, which is sometimes even worse, is stripping away their ability to feel, and you just see people as, like, thinking machines or robots. And it's these kind of minds that we're actually very afraid of, right? So it's this kind of idea that was used in the Second World War to encourage the internment of Japanese folks, right? Because they were these, like, cold, calculating, rational machines, right, that were, you know, bent on the destruction of American life. So it's very easy for us to take those we hate and turn them into objects or machines.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of being able to do incredible feats, what happened to the mind of that 17-year-old who lifted the car?
Yeah, so that was Riley Anderson, and his father was working on a car when it slipped off the jack. And, you know, our work shows that there is a very close connection between minds and morality. And when people try to, you know, do heroic deeds, they actually come to embody the mind of a hero. So think of Gandhi as well, right? Here's someone who doesn't look like a very formidable guy, but in trying to do good for India, he became able not to eat for weeks at a time. And so in the case of this teenager, by trying to help his father, he became physically more powerful. And I mean, and that happens all the time with us. So when we run a marathon and run it for charity, you know, we become physically stronger and have more endurance because helping others in some ways makes our mind powerful.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. It goes to so many different realms when I'm thinking of how we dismiss people whose minds may be different than ours. It runs the whole gamut. We're in this election cycle, too, and we have been for a long, long time, where it's pretty easy throughout American history to portray those who don't think as you do, and we're seeing more and more of that with the partisan divide in this country, is people whose minds aren't very developed.
Exactly, yeah. I think, you know, we often conflate similarity with mind having, and again, that's because we can't directly access other people's minds, right? So you know you have a mind, and you think certain things on political issues, right? And so when other people think differently about political issues, it's just easy to think, well, it's not that they have a mind and they think differently. It's just they don't have a mind at all, right? They're just not very smart.
Yeah. All right, let's go to phone calls. We've given people's minds enough to think about here, and your minds will take our minds in unknown directions. Our guest is the author of The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Kurt Gray is our guest. Kurt is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He leads the Mind Perception and Morality Lab. And has done some very, very interesting research. So the book looks at our minds. It looks at the minds of animals. It looks at how we treat each other depending on what's going on in our minds and who we allow to be members of the mind club, who we identify and why as the enemy. What do we think about, we'll get to this in a moment, people, the minds of people who have died, or what do we think about people who are in vegetative states? Well, let's go to your phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for the author of The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Kurt Gray is our guest, and we start our calls with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. Kathleen Dunn, your programs are just endlessly fascinating, and this is a great one.
Thanks, Carl.
You know, I think of you, Kathleen, who I've never met, as a fellow being, and to think of you as a robot would just really cheapen my world.
I'm not.
I'm down in the basement with my dog, Georgia, who's a stray from Georgia we rescued, and she's down here with me on the hard, cold concrete floor because she'd rather be with me than alone.
Yeah.
And to think of her as some kind of automaton or less than a fellow traveler, fellow human, or a fellow being would just be, I don't know, I don't want to live in that world. There's a sociologist that says we are the stories we tell ourselves and others about who we are and our attempts to live up to those stories. And I think it's important, particularly, and think about this election cycle and that story right before your program with the German person who was calling immigrants trash and cattle. Oh my gosh, we are gullible enough to believe anything if we don't hold fast to the idea that the Buddhist philosopher Thich Nhat Hanh, we are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. Mm. And that is the world that I want to live in, and so that's the story I tell myself.
Oh. Say hi to Georgia. Do you play the song for her, the Ray Charles arrangement?
Oh, she is everything. We have another dog that hates me because she was abused, and I'm a man, and apparently it was a man that abused her. And I give her love from a distance, and Georgia is my baby. So she gets all kinds of good treats and a good life. But I have to say one more quick thing, and that is, you know, when I hear about abuse of an animal, whether a pig, a dog, any living creature, I look at Georgia and I say to myself, you are all dogs, because I can't be there for every dog.
Right.
You know, we can't not drive to the grocery store and we might kill a bug. We have to walk across our grass. We have to live in the world, and there could be damage that we do. But I think if we can just move in the direction of something larger than ourselves and a belief in just the power of sharing this earth, I think we're just in better shape than if we choose to believe that we're the only player in the game.
Mm, thank you, Carl. I like the image of you in Georgia. Thanks for your wise comments. Kurt?
Yeah, I think it is hard for many of us today to think of animals as they did back a century ago. And I think part of it has to do with the luxury, in some sense, of not needing animals to do work for us and not needing to butcher our own animals if we're eating meat and so forth, right? We've separated much of the animal cruelty that some of our lives depend on, right? So for mascara, animal testing, and for, you know, eating meat into different domains, that we can really love animals unconditionally and not be confronted with them. And I think, you know, farming communities are sometimes interesting when children have to take a piglet, you know, and care for it and love it and raise it up towards a big pig and then sell it at the fair, you know, sometime later. So these motivations can sometimes conflict in other lives.
Yeah. And when he talked about this abuse of animals, and let's talk about the abuse of children for a moment, too, I was watching some news report, and I know this still exists in quite a few states in the country, but there was a news report of a five-year-old kindergartner who was in Georgia, thinking of Georgia, who was beat with a paddle by the teacher because corporal punishment is, you know, something you can do. It's within the law in Georgia. And this poor little kid who had spit on somebody, and that was his punishment, spitting isn't right, but really being whacked hard with his paddle. And I know that abuse of children in serious ways is very prevalent in this country. How can we do that? What do we do, our minds do, that allow us to do that kind of abuse to a child?
I think, you know, as I said, we perceive minds along these two dimensions of thinking and feeling, and sometimes these dimensions can conflict with each other. So the more we see someone as a thinker and a doer, the less we see them as a feeler. So think of, you know, presidents or moral exemplars. We see them as very thinking and being insensitive to pain. And so with children, who we usually appreciate as feelers, if we think of them too much as thinkers, that can lead to abuse. And there are some studies that show that when children abuse, like babies, for instance, they see intention where none exists, right? So this six-month-old is crying just to make me angry. He's doing something just to piss me off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think clearly that's not true, but when we see this kind of malicious intent behind what kids are doing instead of, you know, kids just being kids, that's when we're inclined to use force against them.
Mm. And how do we, and what makes us see the intention? How is that formed in our minds?
Well, in some sense, it's the natural response to everyone. So when bad
right.
things happen, we automatically infer intention. And what you need to do is override that, right? So parents, when they see a kid spill something, their first impulse is be like, you did that on purpose. And then you have to take a deep breath and a step back and say, of course they didn't, right? They just can't control their actions or whatever. So it just takes some kind of cognitive control, and you have to be well rested, and you have to be, right, not under a lot of stress. And
mm-hmm.
so as parents, you know, who are maybe under a lot of stress or maybe working multiple jobs, are they less able to correct, and so maybe more likely to kind of lash out.
Thank you, Carl, so much for your call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Kathleen, Mr. Gray. The title of your institute or study intrigues me, Mind and Morality. And the reason I called is I so often have failed to pass muster. I remember being asked at a coffee hour years ago by a man and his wife if I were a member of Mensa. And I had this blank look on my face, and I said, huh, what's that? And then I'm also reminded of the William Dershowitz, or however you pronounce his name, article a couple summers back in the New Republic, where he pleaded with parents not to send their kids to Ivy League schools because he thought they were being developmentally abused. They weren't really being taught to think critically about their role in society and what they could offer society. They were simply in a kind of SAT, GPA, class rank, numerical scores on their letters of recommendation kind of competition to land in a position where they could earn the most money, which supposedly would lead them to the greatest happiness. And I would suppose, for some people, that's one of the greatest indicators of morality. So I'm looking for Mr. Gray's commentary on stuff like that, the classism associated with mind.
Mm, thanks, Rich.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and actually something we don't get into too much about the book. But I think certainly people do perceive mind along class lines. And again, maybe it depends on this kind of thinking or feeling. So we actually have some studies we're doing in my lab right now that look at perceptions of people who make a little money and a lot of money. And I think we typically think of relatively poor people as having lots of feeling but little ability to think. Right, so very kind of emotional and in touch with their senses, but not with the ability for self-control. But conversely, we think of very rich people, and this sentiment came out as your discussion of Ivy League schools, as being in some ways deficient in feeling, right? So we think of the very rich as being, you know, thinkers and doers, but relatively out of touch with their emotions and their body. It makes me think of Downton Abbey. If folks listen to that, right, the kind of like upper crust are very right. repressed and always just doing things and thinking, where the servants are more, you know, emotional and in touch with their feelings. So that distinction is really reflected in our perceptions.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. Pat in Duluth, hi.
Hi, I've been listening to this, and the mind seems so easily swayed and often misguided. And I just wondered if ever it might be time to go beyond the mind, and I don't want to sound too new agey here, but try to enter the realm of the heart and act from the heart, because that's, unlike the mind, the heart can unite us rather than divide. So I wondered if you ever could or in any way are able to enter the realm of the heart.
Yeah, I think I would say the heart is in some ways part of people's conception of the mind, right? So when I mentioned kind of like thinking and feeling when we perceive others, I think we often think of the mind as just about thinking, and you capture the really important idea that we also perceive the mind as feeling and the kind of like truth in conceptions of experiencing the world and sensing. And in fact, it's that kind of feeling that really brings online empathy, right? When we understand that other people can suffer and feel good in the ways that we can, that's when we engage our empathy, and that, as you mentioned, brings people together rather than pushing them apart.
Anything else, Pat? Pat's gone. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Pepin in Milwaukee. Hi, Pepin.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
Poor person from Milwaukee here, so, you know. Anyway, to the earlier issue. I was wondering if you have actually looked at corporations as a possibly new emergent form of artificial intelligence.
Yes, he has.
I'm sorry, what?
I just said, yes, he has. You're asking the right question.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. So in one chapter we call The Group, we look at minds that consist of collections of people, and corporations are one of the number one things we look at, right? Because people think, Supreme Court at least thought that corporations deserve to have a say in political matters. And so what we find is that when people think of corporations, they perceive them as being able to think but not be able to feel. And this is why, number one, people think that corporations are involved in these conspiracy theories, right, because they're powerful without being able to suffer. And it's also the reason why we find corporations so hard to punish intuitively. So when a company does something very bad, you know, we levy fines against them or we fire the CEO, but it's like it doesn't really slake our thirst for justice, because we want suffering when people do something bad, right? We want retribution, and we can't really have retribution against corporations because people can't see them as feeling pain.
Hmm. Let's talk about teaching and mentoring and people who are important in our lives for helping us become somebody who has a valuable life. You talk about teachers being able to let classes know, people in their classroom know, or let individuals know that they have talents, you know, that they can think, that they're filled with joy, or they're filled with the possibility of learning. Those kinds of messages that we give just to other human beings that we're responsible for, be we parents or teachers or whatever. What kind of difference does that make?
I think it can make a big difference. And, you know, there is research on this in terms of, you know, being told that you're of worth and of value, you know, goes a long way to making people feel like they have self-efficacy, and that in turn makes them be productive. In making the book, I should say my kind of personal story, which is that, you know, my advisor mm-hmm. was the one who kind of came up with the idea for the book. And he got sick as we started to write the book, and I finished the book for him. So certainly I felt this kind of connection to a mentor, and it was really his you know, care for me and his, frankly, incredible mind that helped me finish this book for him.
Right. And he knew you could do it.
Yeah, or at least he hoped he hoped that I could, and I was kind of his only hope, so I'm glad it worked out. I'm glad it worked out.
Or we wouldn't be talking today. Our minds would be elsewhere, right?
That's right.
They wouldn't be here right now at this moment. Pepin, thanks for the call. Vince in Appleton, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, I wanted to speak with your guest today regarding, you touched on it in a few of your other calls on different aspects, but I find as a person who is incredibly empathetic and understanding and appreciative of the minds of other people, I am often, what's the right word? I'm often hounded or found to be in the wrong when I try to facilitate understanding between people. For example, there's always those talks of eye for an eye or hand for a hand or he did this, so I deserve to get something back. And I try to show the other point of view in the hope of helping people to better understand each other. And I'm often found to be like taking sides, but in reality this couldn't be farther from the truth. I was hoping that in your studies you have found some way to better facilitate communication in this way with others.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sorry, you're always seen as the bad guy. I think one way we try to bridge moral disagreements that we discuss in the book is really about understanding the role that perceived harm or mind matters in moral judgments. So in the case of abortion, let's say, right, people are strongly divided on this issue, and they think that the people on the other side of the issue are moral monsters. But in fact, everyone understands that babies deserve, you know, inalienable moral rights, and we care about the suffering of children. But what we disagree about is something in some sense kind of banal, which is whether a mass of cells that's rapidly dividing, like a fetus, has a mind. And so these disagreements aren't actually about morality as much as they are about mind or potential mind. Is something that is rapidly dividing that's going to be a person someday, is that a person now? And so perhaps that's one way of doing it, focus people on the harm they perceive and not on the moral issue per se.
Thanks, Vince, for the call. Greg in DeKalb. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thanks for the show. It's a great show. I was wondering if the guest is doing any work along the lines of trying to bridge the communication gap between humans and animals, and if so, what techniques are under study?
Yeah, so we talk a lot about, in some sense, all the studies about animal minds are ways in which we as humans are trying to assess the minds of animals and get responses from them. So there's actually a lot of clever studies that happen, and a lot of them have happened studying whether chimpanzees can perceive minds as we can. So the beginning of these studies looked at whether chimpanzees knew the mental states of humans. So if they understood, you know, if humans pointed at a box of food, if chimps could understand that. I should say dogs always understand when you point a box of food, and chimps almost never do, right? So then people think, look, dogs are smarter than chimps, but other scientists argue, well, maybe chimps' minds didn't evolve to figure out what humans are pointing at, right? Because they don't experience that much in Africa. And so they ran another test that looked to see whether chimps understood the minds of other chimps when they were trying to get food or mates. And sure enough, they do, right? So if a chimp is trying to steal food from a dominant chimp, a big bad chimp, it will take the food that's more hidden because it understands that, you know, it shouldn't make that dominant chimp angry. So that's ways like this, kind of like clever experiments with hidden caches of food or, you know, complicated setup of ropes and pulleys. I mean, the studies are just incredible. But certainly we've done a lot to try to look to see if we can understand the minds of animals.
Mm. And isn't there another one where chimps are given grapes or something, and then they're given whatever the chimp in front of them is given, but then during one go-around they're given something different than the chimp in front of them is given, and they get mad?
Yeah, so we looked at paying it forward. We have a paid
right, bonus, yes.
Right? And everyone, you know, knows the idea of paid forward from that movie. Like, you give someone something good to someone else, and they give something good to someone else. And we wondered whether chimps would do the same thing. And so with humans, in some ways, if you give a bad outcome to someone else, humans can at least correct in some sense, right? Like, you screwed me over, but the next person, I'm going to forgive you and do something
right.
nice. But chimps don't have that ability. So chimps played a game where they chimp A always got a grape, and then chimp B either got a grape or a piece of spinach, I think it was, and chimps love recent macaques, and monkeys love grapes and hate spinach. And so if you know that the other person got a grape and could have given you a grape for free but gave you a piece of spinach, you lose your mind. Like, seriously, they go ape, literally, right? And so
right.
they start throwing the lettuce around their cage and get really upset. And then what they do is they, when they have a chance now to get a grape and then give the other, the next monkey, a totally different monkey, a piece of spinach or a grape, they give the next monkey a piece of spinach if they got one. And then that next monkey, right, freaks out, right? So they pay forward good things, but they also pay forward bad things.
Interesting. Yeah. You mentioned forgiveness. Let's talk about that for a minute. It seems to me as though that's a very hard thing to work around in our minds. Forgiveness is not easy.
Yeah, and I think it's because we typically don't understand what causes people to act, right? We don't think far enough back in our perceptions of others. So if you do a bad thing, you can say, well, I did it because I felt like this, and the situation was like that, and you kind of like make a story for why you did it. But when we think of other people, we just think of the act, right? And we think that they are a bad person that did a bad thing, and we don't think about the extenuating circumstances.
Hmm.
So I think that's why.
Yeah. Well, we'll welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour, Kurt Gray, is the author of The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. He's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and he leads the Mind Perception and Morality Lab. Our phone number, our lines have been really busy, but you can get through now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John in Milwaukee is our next caller for you. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You got a great show.
Thanks, John.
I've read the book. And,
oh, great.
It's actually, I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of people out there, the public, would think that a book like this can be a little dry, a little serious, a little heavy, because of the subject matter. But you actually wrote it very well. You put your personality into it, and it's got a lot of humor into it.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about, you know, how the green bean vine grows, and you put a mind to it, and it kind of, you know, is more active and smarter than some people I work with. You hit that right on the spot.
Thank you.
You know, I look at that too and compare my dog to other dogs, my dog's intelligence to other people, things like that. Those are great books when you can throw that type of humor in there and expand everybody's intelligence. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, serious science doesn't have to be serious is what me and my advisor thought. So we're glad you appreciate the jokes.
Yes. Thank you so much for calling, John. Tony in Appleton. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Great show. Kathleen, at the top of the show, you mentioned, you know, in the tumultuous political season that we're involved in, you know, people looking at people that we might disagree with and thinking that they don't have a mind. And I would just like to ask your guest what he thinks about the concept that we've all been given a mind and a good mind, but what obligation do we have to the people around us to develop that mind that we've given? It just seems so often, you know, if we want to look politically or environmentally, that people just choose to be willfully ignorant. And I'm just wondering what obligation we have to each other to develop the mind that we've all been given.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question.
Yeah, I think that's a very deep philosophical
mm-hmm.
question. You know, I think people believe that they have developed their mind in some sense, right? That they do think about issues, even if they don't. And in some sense, you can't argue from a vacuum, right? So if you, once you, let's say you travel around the world and you meet people who have different political views and different religious views, and then you can realize that before you traveled, you didn't have a rich appreciation for the world, right? And that your mind is now more developed. But you didn't know in advance of traveling that your mind wasn't developed because it was developed for what it was. So I think it's hard to get people to appreciate the fact that there's more out there in the world without actually exposing them in the first place. And if you don't know you need to be exposed, and you're not going to try to be exposed, which is a kind of complicated way of saying it. That, yes, I wish people would develop their mind more, but I don't even know if they realize that they need to in some sense.
Hmm. Thank you, Tony. Robert in De Pere, hi.
Hi. I want to touch on what you said before about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And something that really bothers me, and something that is within my family, unfortunately, is they like to hold grudges. And a lot of the grudges they hold are based off of what somebody else says. And a lot of people do this. They will hold a grudge and, you know, not go indulge for themselves. And some people will even, because they're upset or whatever their feelings happen to be, of someone, embellish, lie, if you will, of one's character, nature, or actions to justify how they feel about this person and so why they don't have to forgive them. I mean, I know this would be a miracle if you could answer this, but why do humans do this?
Yeah, so I think you touched on this general point about how our perceptions of mind and our kind of perceptions of morality kind of feed off one another, right? So if you think someone says something nasty about you, right, that's the kind of immorality perception. But then to justify your anger and your outrage, you're going to make sure that that perception is justified, and so you'll see another person as really meaning to hurt you and as that being intentional. And then if it's intentional, well, then it's even more immoral, right? And these kind of like feedback across each other. One example we talk about is when people, there are French peasants, and this is going to seem kind of weird, but bear with me, when French peasants put a pig on trial. So in their village, there's a pig, it hurts a baby, and then rather than just killing the pig, what they do is they bring in a judge from the next town, call lawyers to like argue for the pig and against the pig. Eventually they find the pig guilty, and then they hang the pig, and it's very expensive to build gallows for a pig. And basically what this shows is that when people feel slighted, right, when they feel insulted or harmed, then they have to perceive a kind of intentional evil, in some sense, mind to explain for their feelings. And I think maybe that's what people do with grudges, right? They feel somehow slighted and a victim of injustice, and then they perceive a mind and their family members to blame.
Mm-hmm. That was a good answer. Thank you, Robert, very much for your call. When you were asked this interesting question, if you had to say what's the most interesting discussion in the book, and heavens knows, Kurt, there are many, many of them, one of your answers was, is there life after death? How does your book take that on?
Yeah, so that's something that all of us will have to face one
yes.
day. And it's a question on many people's minds, especially those who have passed away. And, you know, as I said, my advisor and co-author passed away a couple years ago. So it's also on my mind a lot as I discuss the book. And I think the beauty of mind perception is that not only can we perceive or fail to perceive, in some sense, minds that are right there in front of us, but other minds that are offline or that we haven't experienced in a while, like the minds of the dead. And so, you know, I'm clearly, as a scientist, not sure if there's life after death, although some people claim to have near-death experiences. But certainly there's life after death of other people within our own minds. So it's easy for me to kind of simulate the mind of my co-author, Dan Wegner, and think, you know, what would Dan say in this situation? How would Dan make a joke in this situation? And I think we all experience this with, you know, parents or grandparents who have passed away. We can say easily, you know, she would have loved this restaurant or he would have loved this music, even though we haven't directly experienced them in maybe years.
Yeah, we do say that frequently, don't we, about those who are close to us who have passed on. We had an email from somebody who wanted to know more about your research on people who think they see ghosts. She indicated that some native tribes and tribal leaders often incorporate ghosts.
Yeah, so this project, actually dovetailing with your question you just asked, was funded by the Templeton Foundation on immortality, so perceptions of immortality. And what we wondered was whether perceptions of life after death are hinged upon morality. So there's a reason we see ghosts as often being evil, as in horror movies, or good, right? Good people trying to tell us something. And that's because minds get more power from doing moral deeds, not only in life, you know, with Riley lifting the car of his father, but afterlife. So the more good and evil you do, it kind of fuels your mind after death. And I should say, the one study we've done recently, which is pretty interesting, is that people perceive mind after death depending on how much mind you had at the time of death.
Oh.
So if people die while they're awake, we think that they have more mind after death than if they die while they're asleep. And in fact, we think it's more important to follow the wishes of someone's will if they died while they're awake than if they die while they're asleep.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Kind of weird.
Don't you wish you could take a creature from some other planet into your lab so you could be investigating? I mean, they would get out. You know, they could wander around and take walks. But you could investigate the mind of something we don't know anything about.
Yeah. I mean, right, that's the... In some sense, this is what... things like animals and machines are, right?
Yes.
They're not quite alien, but they're alien enough that scientists debate, do animals have the same mind we have? If a computer can play chess, is it as smart as humans?
Right.
So we can have these debates on our own planet.
Yeah, yeah. And somebody was saying a long time ago, we did this fascinating show on dolphins. I think it was in the National Geographic, and one of the guests who was studying language of dolphins said being able to uncode that language would be as complicated as uncoding a language from somewhere else, because we don't get it. We don't understand it.
Certainly. Yeah, I actually gave a talk a couple months ago, and someone in the audience asked me, you know, you've shown how we see the minds of dolphins, but how do dolphins see our minds?
Right, right.
That's a great question for which I have no answer for.
No, we wouldn't. We wouldn't know. No. Another message from somewhere, Aaron from Oshkosh. What about the tribal mindset of thinking versus our modern way of thinking regarding all of the consuming of natural materials, land, oil, water, etc.?
Yeah, so I think there's a tension in perceiving nature as having a mind or not. So when we look at movies like Avatar or Ferngully, right, it's like very clear we think of like Mother Nature, and that every, what Pocahontas, every rock, every tree, every creature has a name or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And in modern society, right, we just see it as something to be used and abused sometimes. And I think maybe that just depends on experience. So as we spend less and less time in the natural world, we're less able to appreciate the kind of mental capacities of things like plants and animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great. You have a wonderful job because it takes you in all these directions that are fascinating.
I like to think so, yeah. I couldn't think of doing another job, that's for sure.
Yeah, you could or you couldn't?
I couldn't, no. This is great. I get to think about weird minds every day.
It must take you into another realm of being from time to time, too. Thank you, Kurt, so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Kurt Gray, his book is The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Interesting conversation. He's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and he leads the Mind Perception and Morality Lab. Tomorrow on our shows, hour two of our program tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the Milwaukee Area Technical College Promise. This is a program that provides free college education for area high school graduates who meet program eligibility requirements. So that should be interesting, don't you think? And the first hour today, of course, the big New York primary, and we will have two guests with us to talk about and analyze all the numbers and the importance of this primary. It could have particularly big importance for a couple of the candidates. So we will look at that tomorrow during the 1 o'clock hour of our show. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow.